Good evening. Welcome to the Salary Report. Today is June 27th, 2013. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm very delighted you could join me this evening. This evening is my last evening in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm headed down to Los Angeles tomorrow and then over to Texas and then from there back to Tennessee. And it's been an unbelievably productive time in California, and I've really enjoyed it tremendously and hope to be back in California sometime in the fall. So on my way home, I'm going to be spending a day with Dr. Joseph Farrell. Another great discussion on the breakaway civilization is coming your way. We'll see what we cook up. If you haven't listened to the first one, it's under the real deal in the archive, and it's a goodie. So I'm really looking forward to finally meeting him in person on my way back. Couple of upcoming events. You can always find events in our events section on the website. I'm going to be at the Polyface Farm in September, early September, for the wonderful Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund fundraiser. I'll be attending as a benefactor. Then I'm speaking at the Doug Casey Summit in Tucson in October. We have the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. It was in Holland last year. A lot of you were interested in it. They're having a follow-up conference at the University of Colorado in Boulder, Colorado. I'm going to be speaking between October 10th and 12th, and my topic is funding breakthrough energy, crowdfunding, and trends in the financial markets, and then a speech in San Francisco in October at the annual appraisal or the fall conference for the appraisers in the real estate area. And that topic is going to be primary trend in the global financial markets and the impact on San Francisco Bay Area real estate. Our theme tonight is the empire draws the capital home. Those of you who've read my financial coup d'etat story or many of the stories I've written, I've talked a lot about how the empire moved the investment out of the United States and the developed world during the 90s, reinvesting in the emerging markets and in space. Obviously, where our money goes, our military follows. So it's the globalization of another round of investment capitalism, all following the changes in the global trade rules with GATT. And so we've seen capital flow out. And now what we're seeing in the last year is as the money is poured into the BRIC nations, you see them flexing their political muscles. We've had currency wars, various countries in both the developed and emerging markets demanding that the U.S. ship their precious metals back, which are stored in the New York Fed or in the United States. The empire has decided to exercise a little reminder of who's boss. Another way to say it is what Mr. Global giveth, Mr. Global can taketh away. And the blood is being pulled into the center of the empire and the periphery is being squeezed. I don't see this as a change of fundamental direction. It's simply, you know, the pendulum swings back and forth in the rebalancing of the global economy, but the rebalancing is always going to occur in a way that the center of empire is made stronger by it, not weaker by it, and that's part of this little sort of whack back that's happening. It's not just the targeting of the tax havens. We've talked about that for the last couple weeks on the Salary Report and my blog post, Make Way for the Killers and the Targeting and the Great Tax Haven Roundup. We'll explain more about that if you haven't plugged into that yet, but this is going to be the whole, you know, the world other than G7 is going to feel that this pullback. And it's not just going to be the emerging markets that feel it, or the tax havens are certainly going to feel it. This is a process as it happens because the financial system is so centralized and so global. It's a process that right now you're looking at it roll across your balance sheet and income statement as we speak. So I want to start to connect the dots in tonight, and I'm going to be doing more of that in the wrap-up because I want you to see how what the empire is doing translates into sort of what you're feeling in different parts of your life and investment assets. So we've seen tremendous pressure on the U.S. to start sending gold back, whether to Germany, Venezuela, or other countries that have started to demand it. But we've also seen the unallocated bank pools under pressure and all sorts of other pressure about collateral shortages in the precious metal system, as well as other systems, but let's focus on precious metals now. The way to settle those accounts is, if you're a central bank or the big banks, is to basically shake down retail. Another way to say it, the way to settle all the fights among the G7 is to pull it away from everybody else. And yes, you can pass a law and say, we're going to confiscate all your gold, but that's much more expensive and difficult. It's much easier to short the price than drive the price down. I mean, it's even easier. I mean, it's so criminal in laws, it's hard to imagine. You know, your Goldman Sachs, you announce the price is going down, then, you know, but of course, after you've shorted the price, then with the help of all your clients and investors and the followers in the market, you drive the price down. You make a whole bunch of money, including the use of regulatory terror to do that. We'll talk about that in a bit. And then you cover your shorts. That generates profits, and that profit is what you need to fund the purchase of a gold, which you can now get at a much lower price. And then you just send the gold back to the guy who wants it. It's hard for some people to fathom that this goes on, but I think what we're very much watching is the insiders covering their shortages at the expense of the outsiders. Last week, we had Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve, suggest that they were going to stop printing QE at some point, which, of course, everyone knew, and all the folks who've been screaming at him for printing are now screaming that he's stopping. Somebody dubbed it the taper tantrum, as in taper off the purchases. If you look at what the empire is trying to do, they're trying to bring capital back. They have a lot of things going on here in the United States which are strong for their fundamentals. They can bring capital back. And so when you stop buying up, and as you know, I think a lot of the purchases have been pulling the fraud off the bank's balance sheets. And if you look at the stocks of the big New York Fed member banks, they're basically where they were before the bailout. So he's brought their balance sheets and their stocks all the way back, and they're in a perfect position to weather the storm. In fact, it's going to be the parts of not the center of empire, but the periphery who gets squeezed as he does that. So he thinks he's got the center in good shape, and he can start to withdraw from the periphery. Now, let me just remind you of a couple definitions, and a good place to go if you're not familiar with these terms is Wikipedia. When G7 is a group of countries that coordinate particularly financial policy, don't underestimate the power of that coordination when they make decisions. So if G7 makes decisions to start to engage in regulatory terrorism towards precious metal holders and they roll it out, then it rolls across all those countries. Lickety split. It's like a hot knife through butter. And so don't underestimate the power of their ability to get together and change policy. So G7 is US, UK, France, Germany, Italy, Canada, and Japan. Russia is based, G8 is you add Russia. And then also the EU is not a full member, but has representation on G8. And then G20 includes another basket of countries that then bring you up to a major portion of the global economy. It's got Brazil, Indonesia, South Africa, India, China, Mexico, Turkey, South Korea, Argentina, Saudi Arabia, Australia, and the EU is a full member. So we saw the first decision on the tax havens being made by G7. Putin was not invited. It was not G8. Interestingly enough, when G8 finally met in the last week or two, Putin showed up at carrying his own water and food. I don't blame him at all. But now we see with Bernanke making the announcement that QE is going to taper, and we see tremendous drops in growth rate in China and Asia, announcing of slower growth in Brazil. Brazil taking off some of the policies that they had put on to stop hot money from coming into their bond market. Now they're looking for money to finance their bond market. We see announced the U.S. TOPS confidence survey on foreign investment replacing China. Numerous themes, that article is up on the blog. Numerous themes you've been hearing in the Salieri Report for several years about the steps that are being taken to dramatically decrease the cost of manufacturing here, whether it's new fabrication technology or robotics, and of course the steps to increase domestic energy self-sufficiency, both oil and gas and renewables, the so-called oil card I've talked about a lot. But you see those themes played out in this article, and the extent to which in many respects the United States remains very globally competitive despite the, you know, the continued difference in the cost of labor. Of course, labor has come down tremendously in real terms in the United States. Big squeeze. I can't say enough about the impact of the slowdown in China. Think of it as the sort of Walmart carry trade. China buys our treasury securities. Those treasury securities finance giving everybody checks, whether it's disability checks or social security checks. They go to Walmart. Walmart buys all the stuff from China. And then China needs commodities that come from Brazil. And so that's why there's a very intimate dance between those emerging markets and what's going on in the United States, including how we finance it. And anything that ramps down on that so-called carry trade is going to have a dramatic reverberation throughout the global economy. We see riots in Brazil and Turkey and around the world as the capital withdraws and the squeeze is in. Part of this dynamic, though, is technology. You're going to see more and more unemployment, more and more manufacturing done with robots and with, you know, using information technology and new technology to replace labor. And so we have this constant labor devaluation going on, and that's part of what's kept it possible for the central banks to print money to base currency without it turning into hyperinflation. We're offsetting monetary inflation with a variety of deflationary forces. A big one, of course, is labor. As I said, Putin is the, I think, is the stinker in all of this because Putin does not want to see the empire succeed. Putin does not want to be part of one world government. The Russians can be pretty ornery, and they, you know, for many decades have been the stinker for the United States and the Anglo-American alliance. The latest round, of course, is what's going on in Syria, and Putin supplying oil and gas to Europe is a very important part of the Russian economy, and the last thing he wants is big competition out of the Middle East from Syria. Money and markets, so that's the theme. The empire draws capital home, and this is a very big deal, and this is a big change. Think of it as the financial coup d'etat is over. Bernanke has the big banks back on their feet, not to say that we're not going to see some real squeezing and reconfiguring in the financial sector in the developed worlds. We are. We're going to talk a little bit about that later. But now we're ready to proceed to the next phase. I think Mr. Global has in mind that it's going to be a bull phase for the United States. So let's see what happens. So with that, let's turn to money and markets. And I want to start with housing because our interview this week, which we posted this afternoon, was with a wonderful young scholar, Dr. Zinnia Mukherjee from the American Institute of Economic Research. I wanted to have a back-to-basics conversation about housing because the housing market is up. We're getting a lot of questions about should I refinance my home, should I buy a home, particularly in the face of announcements that in April the prices were up in 20 big urban markets, up about 12% from on a year-to-year basis now. Let me just unpack those numbers a little. Those numbers include a very significant amount of institutional buyers. We've seen institutional buyers jumping in and buying up single-family homes for rental and doing the equivalent of what I call roll-ups. In fact, as interest rates have been rising as a result of what Ben has been doing, a series of major IPOs for some of those roll-ups have been shelved and raised the cost of capital for some of those aggregators, and that's going to have a shift in the market. So expect to see the institutional investors slow down a bit. And as that happens, even though I think individual investors are going to be more interested, interest rates are going to cool it off. And we are, of course, coming into summer. So don't be surprised if the May, June, and July numbers are maybe a little less exciting in the housing market. One of the reasons I wanted to do this interview is if you look at the culture in America, it's sort of the lore of the American culture that home ownership is a good thing to do. It's a good financial deal. People are encouraged to do it. Now, if you go back and you look at the price of a home in the United States, a lot of the increase in valuations have been driven by several things. One is the mortgage interest deduction. So we've had very generous deductions for mortgage interest on federal and state taxes. Then you have just a pouring of federal credit into the mortgage market. So we have FDIC credit, we have FHA, we have VA, we have Fannie, Freddie. And all of these things have fueled an enormous amount of low-cost capital and relatively easy terms. Then, of course, we've had currency debasement and inflation and a rise in the value of the homes, really coming from a fall in the value of the currency. And finally, we've seen a significant growth in the size of homes around the country. And when you go back and you look at the historical rise of prices in homes and you unpack and sort of delete all those factors, what you realize is, you know, a home purchase can be as much consumption, if not more consumption, than it is inflation. I always marvel when I'm in Switzerland because so many of the Swiss see the purchase of a home as consumption and not investment. Why would you ever waste your good investment capital on buying a big home? The Swiss are much more reluctant to do that. Anyway, so you've had all these factors that put the wind at your back, you know, or the wind in your sails when it comes to home ownership. And I think there's a significant question as to whether those benefits will be there to support the market and what could happen if there's withdrawn. We've seen different policy discussions in Washington about removing support for Fannie and Freddie, privatizing Fannie and Freddie, trouble financially at FHA. All of that is simply the fact that if you look at what it takes to balance the budget, withdrawing investment capital from the mortgage markets and shifting it into the corporate or business or equity markets is very attractive for a whole variety of sort of overall policy basis. And that puts, you know, whether it's the federal credit or it's the mortgage interest deduction, that sort of puts, you know, these benefits at play. And if they get withdrawn from the market, it can make a significant difference into how house prices will grow. The second thing is we've seen tremendous divergence in the economy. So there are some parts of the country that are doing very, very well, others that are doing terribly. We tend to be people who move around when you have that kind of divergence and you get caught in the wrong place. Things can be very painful. Finally, there is deterioration in the integrity of a home. I put up a wonderful quote from Confucius about the integrity of a nation comes from the integrity of a home. The integrity of a home is really under attack. So property rights are very much under attack in America, whether it's, you know, the NSA invading our homes through our cell phones to listen into conversations or smart meters, which can access all sorts of information about what's going on in the house through the Wi-Fi systems. Agenda 21, which really, you know, sort of starts to negate our water and mineral rights. There's all sorts of other risks. If you get a mortgage, we see more and more servicing and mortgage fraud. I just put up a story about Bank of America by one of my favorite financial journalists, Jonathan Weil, over at Bloomberg, on the servicing, really criminal fraud at Bank of America. It's an enormous, you know, just a hideous story. But there's also corruption in the general population when it comes to buying a house and making sure you know what's really going on, what the problems are, quality of appraisal, inspection, all these other things. And then, of course, you have property taxes and the fact that once you own a home, you're sort of on the list to dig the municipality out of problems if they should have it. So what we have is a situation, and the other thing I should mention is if you look at any estimate by various researchers and experts on how much time it takes you to care for and manage a home, and of course it's much more time the bigger the home is, what you start to realize with all these things, whether it's integrity, whether it's financial, whether it's risk issues, is that buying a home is a major commitment. It can involve you with all sorts of characters that you don't necessarily won't enjoy being connected to. It's a complex decision. It's essentially a riskier decision, and it's one that takes a greater investment of upfront time and thought than it certainly did when I started out and bought my first home. So this is something you should approach with care, and you should really research and know what you're doing, because it's the kind of investment where there are 1,000 variables and one of them are enough to kill you. And so it requires a thoroughness and a complexity, you know, that's very sobering. And so it was one of the reasons I wanted to just revisit housing. Do I want to own a home? What are the considerations? One of the best things about the interview is Dr. Murkaji basically said, look, you have to decide both resources and time, so your money or your time, how much do you want to spend on a house, and what are the other things you can do with the resources and time? And I think that's a very important and very good question to ask, particularly as the signs of strength in the housing market make it all the more enticing for us to jump in. Okay, one of the things that could soften real estate a little bit is we've seen with Ben's announcement, interest rates had been sneaking up. And of course, as you know, we've been talking in the Saleri report about the fact that it's hard to imagine that interest rates could continue to come down anymore. But interest rates started to sneak up. And of course, after Ben's announcements, they really jumped. We saw REITs get hammered about 5 to 10%, bond funds trade off about, depending on the bond fund, 5 to 12% record outflows from bond funds. And I asked our producer, Justin, to put up one of the charts of the U.S. bond aggregate. And you can see the prices of bonds have been falling. I think it's an overreaction. If you look at the sort of interest rates and the way they've been trading in a channel, we're well within the channel, and it wouldn't surprise me to see things turn as they have in the last 1 to 2 days. So to me, it looks like we're in a channel. And I think sort of the Bill Gross's announcement that the long-term bull in the bond market is over is a little bit premature. I would note a very important development that we've been waiting for. Gary Gensler, chairman of the CFTC, continues to insist that he's coming out with a new swap regulations in the clearance system that was required by Dodd-Frank. Given that those swaps, the single biggest volume in swaps is interest rate derivatives, and interest rate derivatives have made a mighty contribution to keeping interest rates down. Not to mention swaps have been very important to sort of manipulating the price of precious metals. So what those new clearance systems will be and what effect they would have on the swap market could be significant. Gensler insists the banks are ready to implement them, but it will be very interesting to see what happens. That comes in July. It's one of those trim tabs that, you know, I always watch out for, because if it hiccups anything, we could get some pretty wild results, or we could just sail through. But it's, you know, kudos to Gensler for hanging tough. It's something we need. Precious metals, we've seen the continued divergence between the U.S. equities and the commodities markets. Just when you think it can't keep going or diverge anymore, it does. We've seen precious metals price continue to move downwards. I asked Justin to post up a chart of the miners, the miner ETF against the triple bear, and you can see anybody who bet big against gold and the miners did well. The price of gold just closing, holding above 1,200 today. That's put prices at this point below the marginal cost of production, and we're starting to see the mining companies throw in the towel. Canadian mining giant Barrick announced they were laying off 30% of the office staff. That's a pretty big deal. Numerous small companies have started announcing that they're shutting down or they're shutting down operations. I expect to see a whole bunch of mergers, and you know, I think you've got 500 to 1,000 companies on the Canadian exchanges or in the U.S. exchanges that just are not going to make it. We continue to see the regulatory apparatus used to terrorize gold and silver investors, both in the United States and Europe. I just keep lists every day of the things reported into me. One of the stories I tell, and this happened to me personally, one well-known broker demanded several weeks ago that anyone with 20% more of their account in precious metals was asked to leave and told to leave and leave quickly. FINRA, the financial regulator, was coming in, and more than 20% was a violation of the suitability rule in Dodd-Frank. Meantime, the head of the firm kept sending everybody emails saying, don't sell your precious metals. You know, it was one of those whoa giddy-ups. But the fear in their voice was noticeable, and so you have the regulators basically making it impossible for brokerage firms to basically satisfy clients who want to own precious metals. The biggest one, of course, was another margin rise on the COMEX. All you have to do is bring the margin price up, and you'll squeeze out the speculators and scare everyone. But the squeeze on China and India is could easily be as big a part of the story because the emerging markets are the biggest retail markets for precious metals, and they're getting clobbered. And slower growth rates in China and India are certainly going to contribute to lower demand and lower prices in precious metals, although we certainly get reports as the price come down of major buying by retail there. It's not just precious metals that's getting the hits. The empire doesn't want leakages. Precious metals is a leakage, just like Syria is a leakage and what Putin is up to is a leakage. There's another leakage we've talked about, and that's Bitcoin. More pressure from state and federal regulators. One of the things you're seeing on Bitcoin, just like you see on gun control or many of these other issues, when a big federal push can't get the work done, you know, you see them pull back and then about 2 or 3 months later, it starts to pop out at the state level. Bill Moyers had a wonderful interview on some of the mechanisms they use to then get together with all the states and start to put this stuff out on the states. It was up a couple months ago. It's somewhere on the blog. But we talked on the Salieri Report at that time about Hot Coffee, which is a great documentary that we did in Let's Go to the Movies on tort reform. And it's an example of sort of how you go state by state. And when you can't get something with a big bang in Washington, you go play trench warfare to get it. But we're going to start to see the state guys go after Bitcoin. And again, that's shutting off the leakage. After the insiders are repositioned with precious metals, I think the shutdown of the miners that's happening right now will make their positions all the more valuable. But it could take a while, and don't be surprised if prices can go lower. Franklin has always said that we could see 1,100 and still be in the primary trend. Others say lower, but it wouldn't surprise me to see us go down to 1,100. July 11th, we're going to be joined by James Turk and Franklin Sanders for the Precious Metals Market Report, and we're going to have a very interesting conversation. James, of course, watching the international markets, Franklin watching the U.S. markets and operating, you know, with coins at the retail level. We'll start to talk about what's the divergence of the paper markets and the physical markets and what's happening and what they see. I think the one thing to remember is I've been so surprised this week how few people understand what the bail-ins are and what's coming. If you remember what happened on Cyprus, we had resolutions of banks without bailouts, but in fact bail-ins. A bail-in is where the resolution is funded by writing down some or all of the uninsured depositors and writing down some or all of the creditors. So they can get 100% write-up or a partial write-off. In Cyprus, a little more scary, we saw even insured deposits frozen for some period of time. And so you literally, unless you had gold, you couldn't buy feed to feed your livestock. And of course, that's one of the reasons they want to shut off leakage like that. But leakage is a good thing to have. So when you think about your precious metals, I really encourage you to divide precious metals up between sort of two pots. One is how much do you need per person in the worst case? You know, if you're in a Cyprus kind of situation, and then your investment portfolio, and you need to approach them very, very differently. The core position is about being free. It's not just about making money. One of the things I want to talk with James and Franklin about is, you know, for many years I've been the proponent of slow burn, and I think the system has far more power to engineer prices with a managed process. And so this will give us an opportunity to revisit that, because we are certainly watching the exercise of those powers with extraordinary global reach, not just in the United States and England, but throughout the continent, and then G7 acting with power around the world. A couple other stories I want to mention tonight. The president's new proposal on climate change very much is a targeting of coal. There's an important subtext you need to understand. Solar and renewables are in the process of taking coal out because of the fundamental economics. It's just the way it is. A lot of it is attributable to the Chinese that have run the cost of solar panels way down in a way that's very putting a lot of, you know, Western solar companies under tremendous financial pressure or out of business. But whether good or bad for us, the Chinese have really pushed the cost of solar panels down, and we're now seeing solar panels reaching the point where solar can, in fact, compete with coal. Now, that's not a practical application. That's going to take another 1 to 3 years. But We're headed into a world where a wide selection and variety of renewables is going to get much more competitive as we're seeing development of the battery technology that's even going to, you know, turbocharge it. The big issue with solar wind, some of the renewable energies, is that they're not a consistent sort of faithful steady supply, and that's where you need the batteries. You get the battery technology economic and reliable, and then suddenly renewables get powerful in a way that they haven't been. And I think renewables are only going to grow over the, you know, from here on out. It's and this is fundamental economics, but the president seems to be taking advantage of it for political purposes. Of course, one pressure on him is to keep doing all of the things we're doing to improve domestic supply in oil and gas, including improving the Keystone pipeline to bring oil down from the tar sands. In the new proposal, he's saying he will only approve it if it's net indifferent in terms of the carbon and climate, and it's kind of a neat little trick, since various experts have already said it is only because the Canadians will be harvesting that oil, whether we pipe it in or not. Go take a look at the stock charts of the coal companies. It's, you know, you can always say one of the good things in your life is that you're not running a coal company right now, because that is a very ugly situation for them. And very ugly charts. Big story about the Supreme Court basically taking a punt on gay rights, moving it back to the lower court jurisdiction, which as a result is a practical matter, then holds in favor of gay marriage. Significant financial reverberations. Most people are just celebrating or bemoaning the case depending on their point of view, but I don't think anybody started to realize what the financial implications are going to be to a wide variety of pension funds and Social Security. So, you know, don't be surprised if there is, you know, sort of the Teutonic plates are shifting financially as a result of that. Under, oh, by the way, but please, 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 please listen to this. It's very important. There was a report, and it's up on the blog last week, that Facebook had offered an organ donor registration and had gotten an unbelievably positive response. Please, whatever you do, do not register your organs on Facebook or any place else. Do not give Mr. Global a list of, you know, what parts of your body are available and might be attractive. Because if you think that it won't be, you know, that you won't be the subject of dirty tricks, or you don't live in that kind of environment, I just don't think that's fair to say. Let's say the chance is only 1%. Why should you take that risk? Please, please do not give anybody the particulars of your organs and why they're attractive for somebody else. We've posted several announcements on the blog. We do have 3D printers making organs for human transplant. That technology has quite a ways to go before it's ubiquitous, but I hope it does faster than Mr. Global starting to look at all of the healthcare databases for available organs. Our hero this week is Glenn Greenwald. He's somebody I've mentioned several times on the Solari Report. He's now a journalist. He was originally a constitutional and civil rights litigator. Very, very intelligent, very grounded. And he's been a columnist for the U.S. edition of The Guardian since last year. He's a very popular blogger. He's been a blogger for quite some time and was a columnist at the Salon and an occasional contributor to The Guardian before he joined full-time. He's the one who coined one of my favorite terms, the one-way mirror. That is, they can see everything we do. We can't even see who they are. And I think Mr. Global's power is entirely dependent on a one-way mirror. And that's why I think two-way transparency is so important to positive change. Glenn was chosen as our hero this week because of his handling on Meet the Press. David Gregory interviewed him on Meet the Press, and I have to tell you, it was one of the slimiest things I have ever seen in my life. The short excerpt is up on the blog. Gregory tried to intimidate Greenwald with the threat of criminal prosecution for being involved as a journalist on the Snowden story. It was, you know, every time I think the corporate media cannot possibly be more sleazy than I have seen them be, it was one of the sleaziest acts I've ever seen. Greenwald handled it like a champion. It was the headline should be sleaze meets quality, quality wins. He wasn't intimidated, and he handled it with the intelligence and the ability of a well-trained litigator. and basically sliced Gregory as he deserved to be. One of the reasons it sort of got to me as much as it did is I watched for many years on my litigation lawyer after lawyer terrorized by attorneys who were so corrupt and so criminal. And they would constantly wave this threat of, you know, we're going to prosecute you if you defend this person. I saw it happen many times. We had one attorney who was the general counsel of the HUD Inspector General, and she used to intimate these things. We caught her falsifying evidence. I'm going to be talking about it in a Solari report. We put the evidence up. In fact, it's up online. We handed the evidence of her effort to falsify evidence in a manner which is clearly against the law. We turned it into the courts, and she was rewarded by, after failing to frame me, she had to leave the HUD IG's office, or she left the HUD IG's office and went to work as the staff to the Ethics Committee at the D.C. Bar, which says everything there is to say about the D.C. Bar in Washington. But I've seen this trick used against lawyers and journalists. There's nothing sleazier, and it's been very effective in many cases. It certainly wasn't effective with Greenwald, and bravo for him. Take a look at it. It'll do your heart good. One of the things that's come out of this focus on the Snowden story and the NSA is it's starting to dawn on many Americans what's been going on for decades. I mean, certainly my experience in 1998 and onward with very, very invasive surveillance of me and the people helping me of the entire situation on our litigation, I got a real education. I call it my enemy of the state period. If you've ever watched the movie Enemy of the State, it will give you a sense of what the technology is like. Another movie we've recommended on Let's Go to the Movie is The Listening. Go back and check that up. Italian film. And of course, there's my article, The Data Beast. But a lot of these stories coming out at this time, it's finally dawning on many people the extraordinary access to information that these technologies at the NSA, the Echelon System, artificial intelligence is giving. One of the things I keep sort of harping on the Solari report, and I want to keep talking about it in the hopes that it can give you a good feeling, is the extent to which these extraordinary databases from the federal government and from NSA, financed all with taxpayers' money, are literally being sucked into machinery that are then used to trade on inside information. These are systems which are used to win at the game of economic warfare. Don't be surprised if they're used in very granular ways to exercise, you know, to push the price of precious metals down at this point in time. It's quite extraordinary how they work. A commentary from William Blum talking about how Echelon was used in several instances of economic warfare will be up on the blog by tomorrow. One of the things that's come out as we've had this conversation is reports of Rolling Stone reporter Michael Hastings' death. Numerous questions. It's inconceivable to me that his death was natural. I'm assuming he was assassinated. But what's interesting is it's becoming much more feasible and understandable for people to appreciate the extraordinary force and violence in the system and the extent to which the intelligence agencies, and many of them, are operating very aggressively throughout the United States. If you haven't, take a look at my article, The Data Beast. I think it will help. Ask Catherine. I get the question again, what's a bail-in? A bail-in is the opposite of a bailout. There was great concern about the bailouts during the 2008-2009 period, and an effort was made with Dodd-Frank to demand that the regulators come up with resolution processes without the taxpayer and the federal government basically insuring more than the uninsured deposits and putting in the money to make things go. And so at the end of last year, and it was posted on the blog, the central banks, the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve published a paper on how to do bail-ins. And what it means is the uninsured depositors and the creditors are going to pick up the tab. And regulators will have broad authority to come in and engineer those things without having to necessarily go through bankruptcy. So expect bail-ins to come. And I think one of the reasons you want to think very carefully about how you handle that period is I think the banks, one of the reasons the banks and the regulators and the central banks are doing what they're doing, including in the precious metals market, is they're trying to batten down the hatches and get ready for being able to do bail-ins. It's something they have to do. You have to shrink the financial sector. Our financial sector in the developed world is far bigger than we need it to be. So it's simply a matter of time of how you shrink it. And when you shrink it with market forces, you're going to have banks going under, and the regulators have to be in the process to do something. Okay, question from Los Angeles. The Los Angeles real estate market is a seller market right now, sitting in a unique situation where very low inventory is chased by a high number of buyers. We are a buyer's sigh. My question is it better to keep our 40% cash we should put down as a deposit in the bank for a time until a more favorable time to buy or buy a single family home right now? Here's what I'm hoping. You're seeing institutional investors slow down or pull out, interest rates rising a little bit, and we're coming into summer. The San Francisco and Los Angeles real estate market have been hot, hot, hot. Let's see if those factors help to cool it down. So I would be happy to sit with the cash in the bank right now, as long as it's FDIC insured. But you want to watch the market closely to see if those three factors give you a little respite in the rise in prices. If it doesn't, it says that the real estate market could be very strong for some time. You're in a high-cost area. The part of the market that's really pushing up, of course, is the $500,000 plus homes, and they are very much being driven by the strength in the U.S. equity markets. My guess is that that strength in the U.S. equity markets is going to continue. So if the equity markets continue strong this year and we don't see the change in interest rates or the institutional pullout make a big difference, then you may want to seriously consider getting in the market this year. Okay, let's go to the movies. I wanted to just bring to your attention the Ken Burn documentary. Ken and Burn and Lynn Novak made a documentary about the architect Frank Lloyd Wright. Wright was, if you're not familiar with his work, was arguably one of the great architects of America, very unique, difficult personality. And one of the things I love about Wright's work is that he did a great deal, with small, affordable spaces, small homes. One of his styles was called the Prairie Style, and with real focus on alignment with the natural environment, use of the sun and the space. But very much focused on very functional, small, and more affordable spaces, but unbelievably beautiful. And it shows an example of many examples of what absolutely intelligent design can do to make a home absolutely beautiful, even though it's very modest. And it's not unlike much of the tiny home movement, which I find very inspiring. I think beauty is so important for our survival. The manner and nature of our space is critical to our field, our health, our mind. And I, for one, am one of those people who would much prefer a tiny home that was very, very beautiful and well-designed to something quite big. And I've lived in both. And I think great design is absolutely essential. So I encourage you to watch that documentary because I think it will inspire you. There are several others, including ones that show you many more. This one is more focused on Wright's life. And there are many more that are focused, really take you through many more homes. And so you can sort of tour around the country and see them. Okay, so let me check and see if any questions have come in. Yes. My niece just bought a house and is scheduled to close tomorrow. However, it's a HUD property and the title is coming. Is making excuses for delay. Why? Good question. I don't know. I do know the subscriber, so feel free to email me directly and I'll send you an email. That would make me a little nervous. I would want to dig in and find out what the story is. Again, what we've seen with properties coming out of foreclosure, and if it's a HUD property, I'm assuming it's gone through the foreclosure process. We're seeing a failure to disclose the things that ethically and legally you should disclose to a buyer about the property. And so this one would make me a little bit nervous. The other thing you want to make sure and check on is we've seen changes by the FDIC saying that when they resell a property coming through their system, they're going to hold back the water and other mineral rights and you're buying the property, but you're not buying the rights to the water and the minerals on your property, and you need to be very clear about what the fee title is you're buying. So with any government sale, I would be exceptionally careful, and I will email you separately. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, coming up, second quarter wrap-up. This is a big one, July 4th. I'll be doing it on Independence Day, and we'll have the transcript up, we hope, within a week after. If you have any thoughts on what you want to cover, as you know, the wrap-ups are a time for me to really help you get a perspective, and I'll be talking a lot about this process of the empire bringing the capital home and what it means to you and me and our balance sheets and income statements. So definitely email or post on the blog any topics you want to make sure I cover. The following week, I'll be back in Tennessee with Franklin Sanders. We'll be joined by James Turk of Gold Money, and we'll be talking about what in the world is going on in the precious metals market. And then July 18th, a great equity overview with Chuck Gibson, Why Dividends Matter. In the last two equity overviews, we talked about sort of the danger of a sideways trading market, and in that kind of market, dividends matter a lot. And we also talked about the changes in the bond market and how it's going to be hard to get the kind of yields we want in the bond market. And those two are very logical move into our topic this month, or this coming month, Why Dividends Matter. So until July 4th, when I will be joining you for the wrap-up, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck. It's my pleasure to welcome to the Solari Report Dr. Zinnia Mukherjee, who is a visiting professor at Connecticut College and is a scholar at the American Institute of Economic Research, of which I'm a member and have great respect for. And one of the reasons I asked Zinnia to join us on the Solari Report is if you look at her research and study and the scope of her economics, it's very appropriate, I think, to the kind of conversation we want to have about housing. And one is that she has done a lot of work on environment and natural resources and what I would describe as the ecology of place and the economics of place. She's worked with the state of Connecticut in the Department of Economic and Community Development, so looked at it from many different that kind of aspects you do when you do that. But she's also studied and worked on housing and but as well on global trade. So this is an economist who can go from the macro to the micro and back to the micro. And one of the things that most interested me is she has said in her presentations before that she focuses on the microeconomic implications, which means what it means to you and me, which is always what I like to bring it down to. So with that, Zinnia, welcome to the Solari Report, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, Catherine, for giving me this opportunity. I'm very happy to talk to you.
Well, you've lived on several continents, so you've grew up and lived in India, studied in India, came here. And so you've seen housing from many different perspectives. And, I find Americans to be surprisingly insular. So one of the things I was delighted to was to have a scholar who has contemplated housing personally and professionally from many different points of view.
Yes, I did grow up in India, and I've lived in the U.S. for the last 9 years. I have been to Europe several times. I've had family living in Europe right now. So, yes, I have looked at housing choices across continents, actually.
Well, tell us a little bit about your work, your focus, why you do what you do.
Okay. Well, I am what one would call an applied microeconomist. So my work involves using economic theory and economic data to understand the effect of individual and household choices on economic outcomes. Also, I study how government policies affect individuals, like how a particular environmental policy is going to affect firms or how a particular housing policy is going to affect an average American family. So that's what I look at.
Uh-huh.
Why I do what I do is basically, I mean, I became an economist because I'm very much interested in understanding human behavior. I believe good lives are built on good choices. So economic outcomes such as the growth of an economy depends on the choices made by each individual in the economy, which would include every household or the families or the businesses and the government. My interests lie in understanding what kind of opportunities and information allows people to make choices for themselves and people around them that would lead to positive economic outcomes. So that's where my interest lies in.
Well, good. I'm a great believer that the power of choice and habit contributes enormously to the results. And, you know, when we look around the world and we see something that we don't like, the first question to ask is, well, what am I doing and how am I contributing and how can I change? So this is perfect. So you just did a big overview of the U.S. housing market for the Institute that you published in May. So I know that that was a significant investment of time and research. Maybe if you could tell us about that and what conclusions you came to.
Absolutely. So I was actually looking at the general health or the general recovery of the housing market, and it looks pretty positive right now. The housing market is one of the biggest sectors in the economy, and one of the reason it's so important is that it links to many other markets. So when the housing market starts recovering, it's actually a really positive sign for the economy. That means the other markets that's linked to the housing market will also start to recover soon. So the good news is that we see a pretty steady recovery at this point. And this, I was looking at the Case-Shiller price indexes for the last several months now, and it seems this recovery is pretty much national. I mean, you'll see some regions probably doing a little better than the others. So if you look at the prices, housing prices going up in Atlanta, it's probably a little more steeper than in New York City, but that's okay. As long as there is steady recovery, it's good news for us. So, but I was also, for that particular overview that I had done last month, I was also cautious about pointing out that it's while we are recovering, it is important to fully try and understand what's driving this recovery. Is it simply that there's a lot of money is floating in the economy that's pushing the housing prices up, or we see a genuine growth? So it's just my idea for that study was to simply be alert to the causes of this recovery. That
right.
will help us to understand where we are actually heading as an economy.
Well, I've been trying for the last year. I work day-to-day as an investment advisor, and I travel a lot in the United States, and what I see is tremendous, you know, I'm not talking as someone studying the statistics, but just from being on the ground, tremendous divergence between places. So in Texas, where the oil patch is strong, or I'm out in San Francisco, where the technology is going relatively strong, prices are, you know, the market is unbelievably strong. Then I live in a rural area. And of course, the housing bubble only reached us for the last couple of months, you know, so, there's been literally no change, or if it is, not noticeable. So I see just on the ground a fair amount of divergence. And one of the things is the markets that seem to be doing well, among other things, have significant institutional buying. So we've had sort of different institutions come in and accumulate a fair amount of rental, you know, single-family properties for rentals. And that seems to have had an effect on the market. And what I can't tell is between those institutional investors and the foreclosure inventories, sort of what's going on, because between those two things you can get a fair amount of swing in the marketplaces. And I don't know if you had a chance to look at, I think you did look at the foreclosure inventories, didn't you?
I did look at it a little bit, actually. Catherine, my understanding is we should see more steeper recovery or more sharper recovery in areas where there's more heavy production activities. Now, you just mentioned about the oil areas in Texas or maybe the technology areas in California. So if those industries are actually doing well, that means you would see housing growth in the vicinity. That
means
they're probably hiring more people who would need, so that means a rise in demand for housing. So people who are actually building houses would have more of an incentive to start the production of houses in those areas. So the most important thing to recognize, at least from my perspective as an economist, is to recognize how closely linked all these markets are. You
right.
see something happening. So Silicon Valley doing great business right now means they're hiring a lot of computer engineers. They need houses, so they're going to. So the housing market, the house home owners would have a good chance to sell their homes in those areas.
Right. I'm not that as familiar. I'm out of date with the housing statistics. Can you see who's buying and who's selling?
Well, right now, I was looking at some recent data, and one of the interesting things that pointed out, like you can see in the data right now, is that there's a lot of multi-unit houses being built after the recession.
Uh-huh.
That single units. Like it's both are rising, actually. Both numbers are actually going up, but you see more, proportionately more multi-unit houses being built right now. So a question is, do we see a shift in the approach to thinking about home ownership?
Now, when you say multifamily, you mean small apartment buildings or duplexes?
Yeah, it would include small apartment buildings where you have a set of apartments instead
right.
of like single homes with a large garden or something like that.
Right. Well, I've certainly seen...
actually has... a lot to offer in terms of thinking.
Or right.
So there may have been some shift in the way people are now looking at home ownership. They still want to own a home, but they're more willing to share a big building with somebody else.
Right.
Another family, let's say.
Well, one of the things I used to work in the government and housing. One of the things I concluded, and I'll ask your opinion on this because you're much more current, is that essentially a lot of the, historically Americans have believed that owning a home was a good investment. And historically, if you look at the success of that investment, most of it came from either the increase in the cost of the average home came from either number one, monetary inflation, or two, the fact that as the federal credit sort of went into promoting home ownership, the average size of the home grew. And one of the big questions I think about a lot is, are we continuing that process of having relatively large homes? Or are we going to now start into a world where, maybe as credit is not available to housing, we start to shrink the size of the house? What's happening to the size of the house?
Well, that's actually an excellent question, and I think that's actually at the core of the entire housing market story. Yes, I mean, home ownership has always been a key part of the American dream, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I personally think buying a home is a very good decision. I mean, it is typically the largest asset an average family owns, so it provides a deep sense of security. But the problem, or I shouldn't call it a problem, but the key question is, how big of a home do I need? And what am I trying to satisfy? Is it a need or a want?
Right.
And that totally depends on the individual preferences. And it could be that the preferences of Americans have actually changed over the years. So in the 60s, it would be like the American dream would be about owning a home. Right now, the American dream is about owning a very large home.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes with a serious cost. and it is totally connected with individual preferences, but it's also connected with how easily money is available in the economy. How easily I can borrow to buy, say, a five-bedroom house when I only need a three-bedroom house.
Right.
And how alert the consumer is, or the buyer is, to his own personal situation. How well can I predict my income changes over the next 10, 15 years? What's my financial situation right now? How much of a down payment I can do, put in at this point? I mean, maybe the requirement is just 10%, but I would probably be in a better position for the long run if I could put in, say, 35%.
Right.
But if I can get a very large home with just 10% down payment, I'm going for it. So it totally depends on actually how, first, as I said, how easy money can come to you, and also what you actually want for yourself, not simply need. I mean, the ability to distinguish between needs and wants is very critical.
Yes.
If you really have a large family, you will probably need a large home. But if you're just three people, you probably don't need a mansion.
Well, one of the things that I think has contributed to the American psychology on that was historically what they saw was most people who got a big home made more money. In other words, with inflation pushing housing up, it made sense to stretch and get something bigger because then it would be a better investment. And that's a historical situation which may not translate to the future. Particularly, you know, because it's not just size. The question is how appropriate is the infrastructure to the nature of the economy going forward. So if you're you live in Connecticut, a big house in Connecticut costs a lot to heat during the winter, and so you know, stretching an environment where the value of the price of homes is going down, and you have to spend more for maintenance, you know. Suddenly, what made sense historically doesn't make sense now.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. I absolutely agree with that. And it's critical to understand the total cost of home ownership for you. It's not just the down payment or not just the mortgage payments. It is also the maintenance, where how easily you can sell it off when the time comes. And also there is something called the opportunity cost of home ownership, which simply means that the more money you're putting in your house, the more money you're taking away from something else. Like, would you be able to send your child to, say, Yale or afford the tuition at Harvard?
Right.
So these are real costs that people must and need to consider. Now, you did mention about the fact that people with large homes made more money. Now, the question is it which way is the direction? Because they owned large homes because their incomes were high in the first place, or the fact that they owned large homes implied that they are rich people? It's both ways. Mm. Something that has actually changed in the United States significantly over the last three or four decades is how easily you can borrow to buy a home. It's become very easy. I mean, I'm not talking about the recent recession, but even before then, it was very easy. I mean, you have all these foreclosure stories, etc. It's simply because it was very easy. It had become extremely easy to borrow money.
Right. Well, there were two things going on. It was easy to do in terms of accessibility, but the other thing is we've been in a very long-term downtrend in interest rates, and one of the things I've focused a lot in the last few months on the Saleri report is the fact that interest rates have been coming down for years, and now we face a situation where that, you know, that it's hard to fathom that they could come down much more, and they may start to rise. And many Americans have not seen that for decades, and that's going to be a very big change.
Exactly. I mean, I completely agree with that. I mean, there has been, the Fed has been very active with its monetary policy over the last 3-4 years. So there has been concerns all around what's going to happen right now with such a lot of money floating in the economy. Prices are going to rise, and how long can they possibly keep the interest rate down? I mean, the Fed had been targeting to maintain a certain rate of interest, but how long can you go with this? So, I mean,
well, it's interesting. I'm of the belief that they can go rather long on it. It was funny when your speech last year at the Institute, you said you were talking about interest rates, and you said something about keeping it down for a few years or 50, and I cracked up. But I think they can go a while now. What's interesting is if you look in the last 30 days, we saw rates start to sneak up just a little bit. Same thing happened at the beginning of the year. But if you look at the impact on, say, real estate, REITs were down almost 10%. We saw several of the aggregators have been aggregating smaller rental property, shelve their IPOs. So you could see real fear and hysteria in the real estate market. And you thought, oh, Lord, you know, for this tiny change, look at the fear and panic. Can you imagine what happens if we get a real jump in interest rates? So I agree that the cost of capital has had a tremendous impact across the board in this market. And we need to remember when we approach it as an individual, you know, we've had the wind at our back, and that may not be true in the future. Who knows what's going to happen, but it could cause a huge change.
And the other thing is that Ben Bernanke's term might be over, and we'll have a new person coming in. We might have
right.
a new person coming in. So will the Fed still continue with the same approach to monetary policy, or can we expect a shift in that approach itself? So right now it's somewhat of an important phase, a transition phase for the economy
right.
as a whole.
There's been a big, you know, what I've seen is much tighter conditions for individuals in terms of getting mortgage finance.
Mm-hmm.
Much, much tighter. So I don't see that accessibility for many people. And it's a combination of several things. But one is that the, you know, incomes are under far more pressure. And I think my question when I contemplate a major turn in the housing market is, you know, you could see an increase in housing in purchases that is driven by Americans taking money out of stock and bond funds and putting it, you know, saying, okay, well, I'm going to buy or I'm going to invest in real estate. But for a really broad-based recovery, you need incomes to hold or rise. And I don't get an indication that we're seeing that, but I would defer to you.
No, I completely agree with this. Like you mentioned about people taking money out of stocks and bonds and putting it in a house. But for that, you need to have a sufficiently large portfolio of stocks and
right.
bonds. And that's more difficult for a younger person or a first-time homeowner to have that. So for the most important indicator, or one of the most important indicator about should be income growth in your industry and income uncertainty in your industry. This varies across industries. It varies by age. It varies by region. So it's critically important for a person who's planning on buying a home to fully understand his or her personal financial situation.
Right. Right. And the sector that I'm in, too. Because as the sector goes, so go I.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably
yeah.
it. I mean, when people decide to fire economists, I'll be jobless. I have to plan for that as well. And, I mean, one of the things, I mean, as I've been interacting with colleagues, friends over the years, and obviously because of my training as an economist, I'm alert to this. I've become more alert to this. It really matters not just how well you are trained in your profession, but what industry you are actually in.
Yeah.
And understand and use the Bureau of Labor Statistics income data for your industry to understand what is the growth potential in your industry. You might have a degree from a very high-ranked Ivy League school, but if your choice of profession is such that there is an income bar which is not really all that high, then you need to plan for that. Or
right.
if you are in an industry where that's accustomed to, say, very high level of unemployment rate or fluctuations, turnovers, income volatility, then you must plan for that.
Right.
Because that's going to affect everything, not only the cost of home ownership, how stressful it is going to be for you, but also how much money you can put in your in the other part of your financial portfolio. So understanding your situation is critical. I mean, a more down payment you put in today, less susceptible you are to future income uncertainty. But
right.
for that, you need to have a lot more money today.
Right.
So timing is very important when you actually decide to buy the house. Timing is important for market conditions, the price you get, but it's also important for your situation in your life and how well
right.
you understand your needs in the coming year. So, for example, you're planning on having a large family. That means more children, more cost for taking care of your family. And that's
right.
absolutely fine, but the more you plan for it, the better you are in a situation in life.
I want to come back to this idea of opportunity cost, which I think is a very good one. It's a very good way of approaching a decision on buying or selling a house is thinking of your opportunity cost. And I wanted to bring up two things. One was, I'm always struck, I usually in Switzerland once a year, and I'm always struck as to how many of the Swiss see housing as consumption as opposed to investment, where in America, people look at owning a home as an investment, not consumption. And I find it's very useful when you look at the idea of purchasing a house and what kind of house you purchase and how you go about doing it to put on both hats. Is this an investment or is it consumption? And if it's consumption, what would I buy and how would I do it? Versus if it's an investment, what would I buy and how would I do it? And one of the reasons I bring that up is I do everything I can to encourage my subscribers to be resilient in their home. In other words, when I look at a home, I think, what can I invest in this home to permanently bring down my expenses? Can I build a well? Can I grow my own food? Can I install energy on an economic basis if I have the capacity to do that? Because that kind of investment, you know, rather than worry about getting a stock with a dividend that might get taxed, why not just put your money in something that will permanently reduce your expenses if you can? And so when I look at the purchase of a home, I look at it much more creatively in terms of what were my costs be over the long term and how can I use owning a home to reduce those costs permanently?
Well, that's actually an excellent point. Well, a house, from my perspective, is both a consumption and an investment decision at the same time. When you're mm-hmm. actually living in the house, you're basically consuming it. So when you're putting money in your house to bring down the total cost of home ownership over the years, you're doing it even as the homeowner. While consuming the house, but you're still investing in it to bring down the total cost of home ownership.
Right.
You can also look at it as more of an investment choice if you're, say, renting out a part of your property. It doesn't have to be that way, but the most important thing to, I think, focus on is, do you have things under control as a homeowner, whether you're consuming it or whether you're investing it for an additional source of income. Now, you mentioned something about a comparison with putting the money in stocks and bonds versus your home, right? And that's actually an important comparison, and it directly addresses the opportunity cost issues that we talked about earlier. So one thing I would be alert to is that pay attention to how long you'll be actually spending in that particular home.
Right.
So, and Americans, my understanding, or people in America, tend to be quite mobile. 5 or 6 years, you might switch jobs. So if it's going to be a home that you're going to spend, say, the next decade or so at least, then yes, it's definitely worth it. It makes perfect sense to invest a lot, bring down the cost of home ownership. And in the past, people were probably less mobile. They stayed at the same company for 20 years or so. They just moved on to higher ranks, but within the same company. Right now, people are switching jobs more frequently. They want more diversification on their CV, etc. So it is critically important to recognize and plan ahead of how many years you can expect to stay in the homes. If you don't go for the entire 10 years, but you're still spending 7 years, that's fine. But if you plan on moving within 3 years, then you probably would be better off putting the money in a stock or a bond or some kind of financial instrument than putting a lot of money in the same home that you're going to sell after 3-4 years.
Right, because it's so illiquid. Or it can be so illiquid.
Exactly, you want to keep it in a more liquid form. Absolutely.
Right.
Yes, Catherine?
The other story I was going to tell you, one of the most impactful presentations I ever saw, I was at the National Multi-Housing Council executive meeting, and there was a professor from University of Maryland who'd invested enormous amounts. His whole life's work was tracking time and how homeownership or apartment rental impacted somebody's time? In other words, how much more time did a homeowner have or a renter have for not owning a home? And, it, you know, it's all very statistical and enormous amounts of statistics. And basically what it came down to was that that a homeowner spent 20 hours a week taking care of their home. And a renter had those 20 hours. And he said the majority of that time went to watching TV. So he advised all the landlords to just go out and get, you know, great cable and forget about it. So, but I was really struck. And I realized when I listened to you talking about opportunity cost, you know, one of the biggest opportunity costs is, in fact, your time and the time it takes. And so maybe you could just say a few words about that part of the opportunity cost.
Well, that's absolutely true. I agree with that. And I'm not I kind of believe the statistics that you just mentioned about spending 20 extra hours on your home.
Uh-huh. And
when you own a particular home, you have a certain emotional attachment to it. You care for it like it's a part of your life. So you probably you're investing more time and money into the home simply because you own the home and it is yours. You might not care as much about a rental property as long as it meets your comfort needs, etc. So, yes, time, 20 hours per week is a lot of time, something that can be used to improve your overall quality of life.
Right.
But that in itself doesn't really speak too much to whether you should own a home or not. But more, it speaks more to at what time or what stage in your life you should actually buy the home.
Ah, okay.
So if you're a young person, say you're a 28, 32, there's no reason to jump in and I have to be a first-time homeowner because the U.S. statistics says everybody must buy a home by age 33. I mean, this is just an illustration.
Right.
So buying a home and even selling it should never be an impulsive decision. I mean, there will be an emotional connection to it, but just think through the situation. So when you... when you're actually making the decision to buy a home, and even you have to consider the size of the home you want to buy. So you need to factor in this how much time you're going to spend per week taking care of the home. If you have a three-bedroom house, let's say, with a small garden that might meet your basic needs, that's much easier to manage than you having a six-bedroom house with sprawling greens.
Right.
But you need to take that into account. A rental apartment or a rental house might not be as large. So it's not so much, it is true that whether you're a homeowner or you're a renter, that might affect the time you're putting into taking care of the house. But it's also true the size of your house will actually determine how much money, how much time and also money you have to spend taking care of that house.
Right. There's a whole explosion of this movement in tiny homes. And when you listen to the people who are involved in living in and buying tiny homes or building tiny homes, what they talk about the most is their time savings, how little time it takes them to take care of their tiny home.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I was in Switzerland last week, and I was in Zurich, and they were talking about the same things. I mean, homes in Europe, I mean, they're not as big as American homes. I mean, they kept saying that when you go to America, everything looks so big.
Right.
And they get the impression primarily by looking at the large houses. But large houses mean more down payment, more long-term interest payments, more everything, more time. And I think this is not so much as an economist, but as an individual, I think it's very critically important to recognize what is it that makes me happy in my life. An extra bedroom or a nice walk or something like that. Yeah, so the more you know yourself, the better decisions you can make for yourself, I guess.
Let's turn to changes in policies, because, of course, I think one of the greatest challenges in trying to figure out if you want to buy or sell a home is thinking about what different government and tax policies. I live in a tiny rural community, and I have two properties and then a commercial property. And you're going to laugh at this because my combined county and city property taxes are less than $500. And my feeling is, you know, if they triple them, I can still, you know, and it was one of the reasons I chose to live where I live was I just didn't want to be at the mercy of, you know, there are some cities, if they double your property taxes, it's going to be $50,000 a year. So I didn't want to be at the mercy of what might happen with, you know, increased local and state and federal debt. And I was concerned that my house be a, you know, sort of an avenue of liability into carrying that debt. But maybe let's just talk a little bit about what the changes in government policy might be and that how that might affect home ownership.
Well, my general understanding is after this recession, they'll try to tighten the markets a little bit. I mean, just right. To provide more financial stability to the economy. We have the Basel III amendments coming on, and the general sense is that in the future, if you're buying a home, my understanding is people might have to qualify under more stringent borrowing conditions.
Right, okay. I think so.
And that would be induced through government policy.
When they were going through the budget debate on this last cycle, you know, if you look historically, you've seen two things really fuel the housing market. One is the infusion of government credit, and as you said, during the last, you know, the last sort of bubble, the terms and conditions of getting that federal credit was very easy. But then you also had the tax deduction for the mortgage interest. And to my surprise, at various times you've seen the Congress over the last 20 years, you know, sort of discuss that mortgage deduction. And of course, then the home builders and the realtors all go crazy and it dies down again. But this last time around, it was raised more seriously than I had anticipated. And I think one of the questions I have is, you know, as they downsize the GSEs, as Basel III rolls in and then, you know, could the mortgage interest deduction, so guarantees are going to get harder to get. I know there's recent headlines that FHA is financially struggling because they've been quite, you know, FHA has been a bigger and very generous part of the market. So if we, you know, could, in addition to the problems with the guarantees, could the interest deduction be on the table? That's a big question mark in my mind, and I don't know the answer.
Well, to be honest, even I don't know the answer. But even if it comes up in discussions, like a budget discussion, I think it's going to take some time for that to actually happen.
Right.
Because that has been a big part of U.S. housing policies that has encouraged people to own homes and go for a 15 to 30 year mortgage loan period. So the tax deductions of your mortgage payment, that is critical. So
if that changes, it could have a dramatic impact.
I would expect it would have a dramatic impact on home ownership, both the number of homes you own or the size of homes you own. You have to struggle against that, but it's going to take a little while. And this is not from any theory or data or anything. It's just from instinct. I think it would take a little while to come around. But yes, I think it's best to be alert to what changes are happening and be mentally prepared to that. Would you still own the home you're owning right now if you didn't have those tax deductions? That's a question.
Right. Okay, so let's look at the generations. I was just reading because you're a youngster, so you can speak to the younger generation, but I just read an article about how the heavy student loan load means that younger people are pushing back home ownership much more than other generations. Is that the case?
Yes. Yes. And I mean, I was looking at U.S. consumer debt before and after the recession by categories, and the student loan debt is pretty high. It is something that has actually gone up even after the recession. So that is a major question. And as for advice for younger generation, I would say just get the math right. That's critically important. And also, like, this is not so much directly about home ownership per se, but it's also a general question that the person must face or will face as you plan the road ahead. The loan that you're taking for to get a certain degree might not guarantee a particular income that you want. So it's critically important to pay attention to the fact that the money you're putting in to educate yourself, is it going to bring the money you need to build a good life for yourself? That would also include owning a home. So I think good planning is critical in this case.
Okay, so let me stop you because I think that is one of the best pieces of advice I've ever heard, quote, get the math right. Now, let me just explain, because I'm not sure the people listening really understand this, so I want to drill down. I would say that every time I have purchased a home in America, just me, I have been much more blasé about pro-forming the future numbers and the impact on my time than I think if I could go back and do it all over again, I would have the Excel spreadsheet and I would look hard at every time and every hour of time. And if I had done that, I think I would have, I would have been much smarter. It was funny. When I was in New York, I bought a big co-op on Park Avenue. And for 2 years later, every morning at 3 o'clock in the morning, I would get up and do cash flows and sweat in a panic. How am I going to do this? And, and it would have been much better to have done the Excel spreadsheet ahead of time instead of 3 o'clock in the morning as I was in a panic about how I was going to meet my mortgage payments. So I think looking hard, thinking of it, because it is both investment and consumption. And I think looking at the impact in terms of your time and your dollars going forward, not just in your current circumstance, but if things change, so please don't do a variable rate mortgage, guys. But if you do, you need to understand what could happen if interest rates rise a lot. Let's talk about the older generation for a second. Is the older generation holding on to their homes? Or are they downsizing and moving to rentals? What's happening with the older generation?
Well, to be honest, Catherine, I don't have too much information on that. But as for the older generation itself, I would say that they probably would want to take advantage of the current low interest rates. If you're in a position in life where it would be better off to refinance your home, talk to a professional, see if you can save a few extra bucks, pay off your mortgage early, and enjoy retirement. So that's critical.
So I just have to ask you, do you own your own home?
No, I don't, but I'm considering. So I'm asking the same thing that I'm telling other people to do.
Yeah. This is going to be, I predict this is going to be one of the most thought out purchases in Connecticut.
I hope so. It better be that one. But there's one thing I really would like to mention is that get professional help if you think you need to. And I'll tell you why I think that's great. Because I have a PhD in economics, but there's nothing in my graduate classes that taught me to be a good investor.
Right.
So we understand the basic theory how market works, but after spending 10 years in school, there is nothing that inherently might make you the next Warren Buffett. So if you need to go and talk to someone who knows more about this issue, do not delay or do not hesitate. There's nothing wrong with it. I mean, I mentioned get the math right. I know when I buy the home, I'll need professional help to get the math right myself.
Right.
I know
one of the things I always encourage people in my network who are looking at this to go talk to somebody who's done it many times. So many people have a friend or somebody who's not only owned and bought a lot of homes, but invested in them. And real estate's one of those things where there's, a thousand things and one of them can kill you. it's very, right.
Right.
Right. And so you have to be very thorough and talking to somebody who's been through the wars can help you do the kind of planning you need to do to really get it to work. Because if you do that planning, it's all about risk management. You do that planning and you can really come out way better than if you didn't.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. Yeah. And you can always learn from your friends' mistakes. You can learn from their good choices and bad choices. You don't want to repeat the bad ones, but you really want to do the good ones even better.
Right. Right. So I love, you know, that's why I love Excel spreadsheets and checklists. And the more you study and research all the different things that can go right or wrong and how it contributes to it, whether it's as an investment or consumption, and your time, because I think the most important thing is going to be, you know, it's what you said, what am I trying to accomplish in this lifetime and what is the opportunity cost? What's this going to take away? You know, I only have so much time and resources. Is this where I want to put it? Well, let's talk a little bit about your work and the Institute, because I think the Institute is one of my go-to sources for information on different planning and sort of questions. So maybe if you could tell us a little bit about your work in the Institute and how we plug in and how we stay current and how we use all the resources available.
Absolutely. Well, as I already mentioned, I try to focus on like micro-oriented studies, and I write for AIR on those topics. So I've written on things like education and labor market outcomes, how education affects your not only your level of income throughout your entire lifetime, but also how education secures you against unemployment rate, even during terrible recessions like the previous one. So this is one thing I've worked on. I've already written a few times on housing. I've written on the connection between developing economies and the United States. I've done a little bit on trade issues as well. But yes, because I'm a microeconomist, I try to look at the issue from the perspective of an average American family. Mm-hmm. And my efforts go to like connecting it with what like it's something you can discuss at a dinner table at home, how it affects you. So even if I'm talking about something about, say, monetary policy, which I don't do normally, but if I had to do that, I would focus on like how do I relate it to an individual. So that's basically what I do for AIR. I write on those kind of issues. Another topic I've written on recently is about tax issues, corporate taxes, United States versus other OECD countries, and what it means for a tax reform in the future. So these are the topics I have actually written on so far. I am always available through email. I'm my first name dot last name at AIR.org. And just write to me or feel free to contact me anytime if you need my comments on anything you think suitable.
Okay. Okay, well, that's very... I do want to mention I'm a member of the Institute, and it's pretty easy to join, and there's a wealth of financial planning. I always recommend... I don't have it off the top of my head, but there's one book on sort of, you know, financial and legal, all the things you need to know to not get in real trouble. And the information on healthcare proxies and sort of planning for those is really good. Anyway, but there's a wealth of information at the Institute, which is, it's AIER.org, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Okay. Okay, well, Zinnia, I can't thank you enough. And I hope that your decision whether to buy or not and which house to buy is the wisest you could possibly do.
Thank you so much.
Because I know our subscribers' decisions will be wiser for your presence in their lives. So I can't thank you enough for joining us
on
the Solari Report.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye.